I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Oh, thank you so much. We have about an hour, but you guys look like quite a sharp crowd. So maybe we'll do less talking and get more questions. So do think of questions. Yes, I'm Shahida Bari. I'm an academic at the University of the Arts London, and I'm a broadcaster for the BBC Two, and I'm your chair for this evening. And of course, I'm talking to Vigdis Hjort, and we're marking the publication of her novel, Is Mother Dead? Vigdis, as you know, is an award-winning Norwegian writer who's written over 20 novels, translated into many languages, several translated into English, among them Long Live the Post Horn, in which a PR, I've just been reading this one, in which a PR consultant helps a trade union fight an EU postal directive. It's my kind of novel. It's been called a joyful story of social justice. And more recently, Will and Testament, which sold over 150,000 copies in Norway, received several awards, including the Norwegian Critics Prize for Literature and the Norwegian Booksellers Prize, as well as being nominated for the Nordic Council Literature Prize and the National Book Award. So a big deal. And those of you who know it, it's a family saga about sibling disputes, parental relationships and abuse. It's complex and impactful, and it gathered considerable attention and controversy from Vigdis's family, as well as the general audience. Today we're talking about the new book, also about frayed family relationships. It's been described as a cat and mouse game of surveillance and psychological torment that develops between a middle-aged artist called Johanna, is it Johanna? Mm-hmm. Johanna and her estranged mother. Recently widowed and returned to Oslo after a long absence as she prepares for a retrospective of her artworks. The subject of her work is motherhood, which is the source of a dramatic rift between parent and child. And now tantalizingly close in Oslo, Johanna thinks of her mother obsessively and stalks her home. Vigdis, welcome. We're going to talk together and then we'll take questions, but we're going to start with a reading that you've selected for us. This is from the introduction, but feel free to say a few words if you would like to before you read.
No, I can just read, I think.
Okay.
From the very beginning. She would contact me if Mom died. She has to, hasn't she? I called Mom one evening. It was in the spring. I know that because the next day I went for a walk round Borøya with Pax, and it was warm enough for us to sit on the bench by Osesund and eat our sandwiches. I had barely slept that night because of the phone call, and I was so glad by seeing someone that morning, and that someone was Pax. I was still shaking. I was ashamed to have called Mom. It was against the rules, and yet I'd done it. I'd promised myself I wouldn't, and they wouldn't want me to anyway. Nor did she pick up the phone. The busy signal started the moment she declined the call. And yet I called her back. Why? I don't know. What was I hoping for? I don't know. And why this paralyzing shame?
Thank you. Wow, what a beginning, right? And what a premise for a book. The blurb of the book, you observe, to mother is to murder, or close enough. That's what Johanna thinks as she looks at the spelling of the two Norwegian words. And it turns out in English, mother and murderer, not so far apart either. What do you mean by that relationship between those two words?
I think that Man is always very ambivalent to the people you are depending on. And a child is always depending on the mother, the father, the primary caregiving person. So of course, that this, if you see a biologist, that's my editor. I always have her here to, when I lack the English words, so she can help me. And this mother, she's carrying this baby in 9 months, and she's feeding. The birth is painful, and it's just to the breast to have food. Yeah. And of course, that intuitively, this child knows that I'm depending totally to survive at this person. And that's the kind of, and some mothers have never been loved, or parents have never been loved as much as they are loved by a child. And somebody will stimulate that symbiosis because of they get so much from the love of the children. So it's not, the other day I was in a cafe and watching this young mother with a little boy on 5 or 6 months, and then mother was going to the toilet and he started to cry, of course. And then the mother was smiling. Oh, I just walk away and he's crying. So it's a kind of very ambivalent. And I think that the question in the book is mom dead? The question is rather, can a mother die? Yeah. No, she cannot, never inside the child. She's always alive.
Yes. And the question for Johanna is, what happens when your mother severs that relationship? Even though she continues to be alive in you, what happens when your mother severs that relationship? Why, I think we already know, but tell me in your words, why did you want to write about this particular relationship?
It's easier to talk about it when I'm in London.
Really?
Why
do you say that?
No, because that it's not a secret in Norway, right, that I don't have contact with my mother or my family. I can have contact with, my father is dead, but I have contact with my brother, and that's that's very nice. But and sometimes I have called, like Johanna,
yeah,
but mother never picks up the phone, and I have felt so much ashamed, and I have been wondering about that shame. Yeah. And when I start to write a novel, I always start with a kind of personal dilemma,
yes,
or an ethical dilemma. But I would never write a novel about it if I didn't knew or suspect that I was sharing this dilemma with a lot of people.
Yes.
And I think that in one way that the sister and the mother, they never take contact. They know she is back in the country after 30 years. They don't take contact with her. And when she phones or writes SMS or letters, they don't take contact with her. And in Johanna's mind, she feels so childish because she...
Hun kan ikke la være.
Yeah, she can't help it. She must stay in contact. She has much contact with this desire in her.
Yes.
But they seem to be grown up. We have decided not to have contact, and then we don't do anything.
Yeah.
So she feels childish.
In her
feelings. Her feelings taking over.
Yeah. It's so difficult to interview Vigdis because I was thinking, oh, you know, I'm not going to ask the personal questions, but you elicit the personal questions because the books do. So feel free to say no if you don't want to answer the personal questions. But when you say that you call your mother, what do you want from her?
I don't know. But I think I find out things by writing.
Yes.
And I think that when Johanna is coming back to her her childish town. she is starting to think about her mother as a young woman. And she finds out that the mother has had a very hard childhood. And she seems to understand that my mother has had a lot of pain, but untreated pain.
Yes.
And the people that have untreated pain can be a kind of living dead.
Yeah.
And when Johanna understands this, she wants to help the mother to get rid of the pain, to relieve the mother from the pain, and to relieve herself. So she has that hope. And I think that's very naive.
Yeah.
But still, you can't help your hopes.
Okay.
And the first time I was interviewed by this book, after we had been on the stage, we were out eating, and then I had this big pizza, and I couldn't eat much of it. And then the servant were coming and asking why I hadn't eaten. And I said, no, it's just too much, too late. And the interviewer said, that's Johanna as well. She's too much, too late. And I think that's true. But we are childish, even though... And the longing for your parents can be alive, even though they are dead.
Yes.
So,
In a way, that is the perfect answer to the question, what do you want from your mother? And I'm going to come back to it because I think it's a question for all of us, whether our mothers are living or dead. What do we want from our mothers? And I don't know that we know the answer, but this book certainly takes us there. Let me take a step back, though, from the personal, even though I'm desperate to get to it. Did you do research for this book? Were you reading about mothers?
No. But I never do. I never do that. But it's a kind of... it's about my experience, my thoughts, but it is a novel. It's fiction.
Yeah.
I have never done what Johanna has.
It's also, we should say, I mean, you're already sold on this book. You should be. It's wonderful and hard emotionally. But we should also say, am I right to say this? It's a thriller too. There's an element of subterfuge. Johanna is hiding in the cedars and behind a car. She's surveying her mother, and at any moment she might meet her or confront her or not. So is it right that it's not just, it couldn't simply be a memoir? This also has to have an element of mystery or thriller and suspense too.
Yes, but I think that...
Tension, at least.
Yeah, but I think that... Strindberg, in a play of Strindberg, it's called The Dream Play. There's this character going through the play four times, and it's a lieutenant, and he's very in love with Victoria in the theater. So he's coming the first time, you know, with flowers. Victoria! She's not coming out. Victoria, third time! Victoria! And the last time, the flowers are dead, and he's Victoria. Oh. And it's something that with hope. And I think that what Johanna has to common with the main figure in Will and Testament is that they are knocking on the door or a window to the family,
mm-hmm.
and it's not open for them. So they're knocking on the door, it's not been open. And to hope and be... denied. It's so painful and exhausting. So they have that in common, that they seek the total rejection. Rejection, obviously. And that's what when Johanna is denied this conversation that would be very enlightening, she thinks. Then she must, and she has this theory about the mother's pain and why, and to have to know.
Yeah.
She's forcing herself into the mother's.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then afterwards, she can leave because it's a freedom in the resignation.
In accepting not knowing or not...
No, but she knows. She finds out something.
She does, yes.
She finds something.
Yeah.
So, but to hope and be... and it's so it's freedom in the resignation.
In the resignation.
And I'm a little like both of these characters.
Like the mother and
Johanna. No, like the main character in the Wilhelm Testament and Johanna. And an example is that I was working at a theater as a young girl, and I was, of course, very much in love with this handsome actor. And on a feast, a party, then I asked him, do you want to dance with me? No. Do you want to dance with me? Third time, do you want to
and
dance with me?
And the flowers wilted.
Yes. Yeah. And then I tried to be a psychologist. So, you're nice with your feelings, show a lot of feelings on the stage, but are you afraid of feeling in real life? And then he went to the toilet, and then he was coming out, and I was like, you want to dance? And then he took my hand.
I don't want to dance with you.
And then it's very clear.
Yeah. And it takes a while then.
Yeah, but I think that it's... When the room is enlightened and you know how your circumstances are.
Yeah.
So rather to be... Yeah.
Yeah. We're laughing, but also I... think we're on your side, right? We want him to dance. Why doesn't he want to dance with you? We want him to dance with you. And then we're angry at him when he's angry at you. And then feel terrible for you when the resignation comes, when you have to come to terms with
it. Yeah, and you can walk up. You give up hope.
Yeah. The book is also, obviously, Vigdis is a performer. And the book is full and wonderful.
No, I help my English with my body.
It helps a lot. But the book is experimental too. There are pages with just one line. I picked one out. Page 240 in this edition. You can just see one line. So I tell myself I have successfully rejected my mother. Ha ha, ! And I wondered, tell me your thinking about this element of the book where there are longer passages and then there are just sort of almost mysterious lines like this.
I write very intuitively. So I don't have it just happens to be like that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a little bit more about Ruth, who is the other character in the book. Ruth is the sister. Mm-hmm. And this is a really important... She's as important as a mother in some ways because Johanna is thinking constantly about how Ruth is mediating the relationship between her and her mother, whether Ruth is obstructing the relationship. And Ruth becomes the object of lots of speculation too. How is a sister relationship, having a sister too, is also complicated. How does a sister complicate the relationship between a mother and a daughter?
I think that children can be konkurrenter. Competitors. Yes. And I think that sometimes the parents can stimulate the competition if they are not wise. So I think that Johanna, it's so difficult for her to accept or to believe that the mother really doesn't want to see her, to ask her, 30 years, what have you done? Yeah. Tell you about it's unbelievable that, and then she finds out in her mind that it must be Ruth. Ruth is the person who says to the mother, "Don't meet her.
Yeah,
never remember how much pain she has caused you." All that kind of thing. So it's easier for Johanna to accept that Ruth. The competition person is the one that has the power in the relation because the mother is old. But also I think that when Johanna leaves she's 22, 23, she leaves the town, she leaves the marriage, her studies, suddenly and during one hot summer. And then, of course, when she make that choice, the choices of the possibility to choose for Ruth is inskränkt. Also, she must be there when Johan has. She must be there with her father and the mother. So maybe Ruth is angry about.
Yeah.
Well, you choose to go away. I'm stuck here.
Yeah, Ruth has her own thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a kind, Johanna has this paranoia about Ruth, but your writing also allows Ruth to have a humanity too, that you suspect that there is pain and suffering for Ruth too. Let me ask you about something slightly different. I was asking you about your experimental writing, and you were being very modest that this is intuitive, and I totally believe you that it is intuitive. But there is a moment I want to talk about, the fact that Johanna is an artist, of course, and the work, she's a visual artist, and the work that she produces are often called mother and child, or on themes of mother and children. And this is page 253. Johanna is interrogating her own motivations. So she asks herself, yes, of course, but be honest, didn't you have your own mother in mind when you made those works? No, it was the feeling of being a child I sought to express, etc., etc. And she's sort of trying to wrestle with her own motivations. And then she says, well, she reflects, but an artist must accept that a specific mother might get hurt and be offended by a work of art and not surprised by it. Especially when the mother in the painting has red hair, just like the artist's own mother. I'm going to talk about your humour in a moment, but I wanted to ask you about these questions because, of course, they're relevant to your work too. Must an artist accept that a specific person might be hurt and offended by their work?
Yes, I think so. If you choose to write like I write, or to paint like Johanna paint, you should not be surprised. So you can choose not to do that kind of things, but it's very difficult if you should write a novel and not use the word mother, father, brother, sister, family, because one special family, sister, brother, then you must write novels about bicycles and that kind of thing. So, of course, you can. So, but I still think that my family has reacted very strongly when the Will and Testament was published in Norway. But what they mainly say is that this is us. You are writing about us.
Yes.
But we are not like that. No.
No, exactly.
Because it's not you.
Exactly. Yes.
So it's a kind of what they say is a kind of paradoxical.
Yes.
So, but I think also what I in this novel, I have I give myself the opportunity to comment on the relation between reality and art, because there is a relation, of course.
Yeah.
But it's the transformation from experience to art, it's a very difficult, and but it is a transformation, and you feel it when it's there. So and I think that this term reality fiction that they have used in Norway about works like Karl Ove Knausgård. The novel as a genre has always been very close to reality.
Yeah.
But still, of course, a novel on 300 pages could never tell the whole story of a whole family. It's, of course, a kind of structure, literary structure.
Yes.
And you can imagine yourself, if you wanted to write about your own life, even if that was your purpose, should you write about every person you went to the kindergarten with, everybody you went to school with, every Christmas, all the family, the neighborhood.
I would read that book, but you shouldn't.
But six novels, six volumes are not enough.
Yeah.
So you have to choose it. Once you have written one sentence, you have started to make its structure. So
I had all these mental rules in my head of questions not to ask you in this conversation, and meeting you and talking to you has made me throw those rules out the window. But you mentioned Nausgaard, and I was thinking it's difficult when women writers are likened to male writers. That's an impulse that we often have. And the parallel to Nausgaard is often made in your case because of that kind of very detailed, scrupulous, meticulous kind of self-inspection that you do. But I wonder what you think of that likeness. Is it?
I think we are very different. We are very different. No, we are very, very different.
And
He's using. But I'm a big fan. I love his work. But he's using name of existence, people that exist.
Yes.
And I have never done that. But also that is not new at all. Dante in Divina Commedia, he places his enemies on different stages in hell with their real names. So it's an old trick, you know.
Yeah.
But what I think has made this I can start another way. In the Norwegian Writers Union, we are 500 members.
Uh-huh.
And these members, they are divorcing all the time. And regularly after a divorce, will be the writer.
The divorce novel.
Will be a divorce novel. And of course, some colleagues can recognize something, some situations, something like that. But because these novels are selling 100 copies,
right?
Nobody cares. Oh, maybe the little family around them can be, I didn't like who wrote that. But nobody cares. But what was happening with Klemsgård? The whole of Norway was reading him.
Yes.
And he was surprised of that. He didn't expect that to happen. And because of the press was following up all these readers, they could, and because he used name of existing people.
Wife, yes.
The Norwegian newspaper could go and to knock on the door to the teacher of Knausgård and say, what do you think about him writing, you are a bad teacher?
Horrendous.
So it became a media phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I think that he was very surprised and he didn't expect that.
Yeah. It's interesting hearing you talk about this branch of Norwegian divorce writing. There should be, if Claire said, we need an LRB corner, which is just Norwegian divorce writing.
Yeah.
Because I want to ask you it's always interesting to hear how Nausgaard is understood and regarded in Norway. But I'm interested in if you feel like there is a wave of Norwegian writing that includes you and whether that has a distinct flavor. Who are you reading, for instance, right now?
Norwegian writers.
Yeah.
I'm reading a lot of colleagues. I'm reading Knausgård, of course. Yeah. I'm reading Hanne Ørstavik. It's that names that come into my head.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of good Norwegian writers.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, we need that shelf in the LRB bookshop. let me ask you a different question about Is Mother Dead? I'm interested that the book doesn't have a question mark. Mm-hmm. Is Mother Dead is not a question, or is it a question?
No, but I can tell you how I got the title. Yeah. I was writing the novel and I was nearly finished. Then I was taking care of a little boy, 4 years old, and his mother was out running. But this is a poor mother.
Uh-huh.
She had a new iPhone, and he had taken the mother's iPhone, without me recognizing that. And then he smashed it on the bath floor. Right. And he was terrified. What will happen now?
Oh.
And at the same time, I got a serious phone call. So he could listen that I was saying, oh no. Oh, I'm coming just in a hour. Oh. And then he said to me, with a kind of hope, but also afraid, is mom dead?
Oh no.
And then
kind of hope.
Yeah, but also afraid. But then
That's amazing.
The ambivalence of the child.
Absolutely. Because then ambivalence.
Han ville gå glipp av den kjeftingen.
Yeah, he wouldn't have to demand the consequences. Yeah. He wouldn't be reprimanded. Yeah. Yeah, I still have that feeling sometimes in my life.
Yeah, you can see
it's
that.
It's amazing. Yeah, that is an amazing. That question, where did your title come from? Sometimes is a boring question, but that is an amazing answer to that question. The question I'm trying to get at is whether the way that you inspect Johanna's feelings and the obsessive way that she imagines and examines her mother and her estranged sister, Ruth, that kind of self-scrutiny and examination it's really grueling. It's hard. She's reflecting on her failings. Is it my fault? Have I made mistakes? Do I have regrets? And I wonder whether for you, if there is a moral or ethical impulse in your writing. Is it just I'm exploring these emotions, or is there a moral or an ethics to these relationships that you're exploring?
No, not really, not like a moral. But I think that's one thing. When Johanna is too much too late, and maybe she's childish, but we all are, because the child we were is living in us. But I was thinking about the shame that Johanna feeling after she has called her mother. And then, you know, we are living in a culture where to be loved and to be that others should desire us.
Yeah.
It's very dominating. And we are, you know, self-iscenesettelser. We are presenting ourselves because we want the other one to see us and desire us. And perhaps also love us. And that's so much in our culture, so dominating in our culture, that even though two people fell in love and get together as a couple, it's shameful to be the one that is SMS too much.
Yeah.
Nobody wants the one to love the most.
Yeah, it's an Auden poem, I think.
Yeah, so there are kind of competition about to love a little bit less than
there's
the other.
A bit of dignity or something in
there. So there's a kind of off-loving process going on. And I was in a kind of off-loving process in the start of a relationship with a man.
Yeah.
And then I suddenly read a poem of Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke, and it goes like this in English: to be loved is to perish. To love is to persist. To be loved is to burn up. To love is to shine with inquenchable flame. And I think that I said to myself when I read that, if I should be so lucky to experience love again, I'll go all the way.
Yeah.
But it's vulnerable, of course.
Yeah.
But still, it's so in one way, I think that Johanna so much want to, it's a good thing. She isn't proud enough to say that I don't care.
Yeah.
She shows that she cares.
Yeah.
And we should all do, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
Or are we very weak when we show we care? Or
Yeah.
So that's, I don't land it, I think, but I try maybe to say that I can understand. I can understand her.
Yeah.
But she goes very
too much.
Late. Too late. Yeah.
But if you are that kind of person, And I'm not suggesting that you are, Victus. But if you are that kind of person who loves too much, is too much too late, you can't do anything about that, right? There's not something one can fix.
I don't know. It's a lot of psychiatrists, maybe. But I have been to a lot, and I'm still mad. So no, but somebody says that
we're all mad here.
Is writing therapy?
Yes.
No, then writers would be healthy.
Right.
We are not.
Yeah. You've been so entertaining. We have to ask you about the humour. This is not to give anything away, because there's a lot of things that are revealed as we go along. But there is a joke at the end where you say, there are many ways to leave your mother more than 50, which is obviously a bleak pun on the song. And Is Mother Dead, if you hadn't already guessed it, is also a very funny book, not just agonising. And I wonder what the role of the comic is for you, what laughter and humour does for your writing and the way that you're thinking about these relationships.
No, but I think that humour is very... So Freud has written a whole book about the joke.
Yes.
It's very interesting because it's so much truth in humour. And I'm quoting a scene from Roy Andersson's film, a Swedish filmmaker. And that's about two sad, not successful toll sellers. And they are sitting in a sad motel out in the woods in Sweden and haven't sold any toys. And then they have each room each. And the one is playing this old folk song in Norwegian song. Dear Anna, if you want, be my wife and have a lot of kids with me, and then we will live in good days and in bad days. And and he's saying the last words, he's playing that again and again and again. And then we will die and we will meet father and mother again. And he's playing that again and again and again. And the colleague was coming and knocking on the door and said, listen, what's happening here? And then the other one is crying and crying and crying. He said, why are you crying? Because I don't want to meet mother and dad again in heaven.
Yeah.
And I think that's humor, but still it's true. Who of you want to meet mother and father again in heaven?
Yeah.
Very few of us, I think.
Yeah. Maybe in the other place we have to meet them. I'm going to come to you guys. I know you've got questions, so get them ready. But one, like you mentioned Freud, and earlier you said, I didn't do any research for this. But this is a philosophical book. It's an existential book. And I wonder if there are other parts of your thinking, your philosophical reading, psychoanalytical reading. I thought of Melanie Klein often, Julia Kristeva, Kierkegaard is obviously...
Kierkegaard,
of course, is the one. Tell me about that.
No, it's difficult to explain in English for me because it's a difficult philosopher. But he's saying something that to be a living person on the earth, it's a big thing.
Yeah.
So a split second in the big time, you are a person. And it's an oppgave. It's a gift and oppgave. What is it? A task. A task. And in Norwegian, a gift and a task is almost the same word.
Right.
And he said that, so you must be the little time you have it must be a human being with all your indrihet, all your passion, and all your responsibility. And he said that it's so many people living in the basement in themselves, even though it's empty places in the high floors where the view is exceptional and then... and the perspective is evigheten, the eternity.
Yeah.
So I try often to get my persons, my character I'm writing, up from the basement up to the higher levels.
Yeah.
And then I using in Kirkegård. And I can tell a little story about when I was in a little church in Armenia, and I was a stone church, very little. I was the only person there, and I was taking a light on.
Candle,
yeah. And I was thinking about the people I care for, and then the flame was shivering, and it was still. Is there wind? Altså, trekk fra et eller annet sted?
It's a breeze or a wind?
No, it was my breath. And then I understood a very Kierkegaard thought, just by living, just by breathing, I'm getting things to move. And that's a big task and a big responsibility, that you just by living, to be together with others, are moving. And we know, all of us, that one person, a new person, can come into a room and the room will change.
Yeah.
Big responsibility to be a human being on earth, but still also a big possibility. So responsibility and possibility.
Yes.
And so I think that he's writing. So I just love him. And when I'm very depressed, and I often are, then I read him.
Me
and
too.
So
I'm with you. I'm with you on that. I'm going to come to the audience, but I want to come back to that question about when you call your mother. Does she know it's you? Do you think she knows it's you?
I think I'll say something that maybe it's not. I think she hopes it's me.
Mm.
I think, or maybe I tell myself this because it's a good and warming thought. I think she really wants, but she has not, she's prouder than me.
Yeah.
She must be curious.
Yeah.
She must be curious.
Yeah.
I'm so curious.
Yeah.
On her life.
Yeah.
So but impossible not to be curious.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. I don't know.
Thank you for that answer.
Hello, listeners. The London Review of Books has just launched a new subscription podcast called Close Readings. For just $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year, you can access all our Close Readings series. This year, we have ones on classical literature with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones, medieval literature with Irina Dumitrescu and Mary Wellesley, and 19th and 20th century literature with Mark Ford and Seamus Perry. Each series has 12 episodes, so you'll receive a new episode from each one every month, and you can listen in most podcast apps. To sign up, go to lrb.me/closereadings or click on the link in the description.
Let's get questions, shall we? People have questions, I imagine. Don't worry, I've got lots of questions, really impertinent ones like that one. But if you have questions, then that's excellent.
Hi, Vigdis.
Hi.
Thank you for that, both of you. It was really interesting. I'm really curious about the fact that you've been a high-profile writer in Norway for a really, really, really long time, and then it's only in the last few years, unless I'm mistaken, it's only in the last kind of 3-4 years that your work has been translated into English and has kind of found that particular kind of international audience. And I wonder if you feel that that has affected your relationship with your work. I mean, I thought it was interesting what you said earlier about how you can talk more easily about some of these subjects in, you know, when you're here than in Norway. And I wondered, whether it's affected your kind of relationship with your work at all, or I don't know, whether it's elicited like different kinds of reactions than you would have expected. Whether you've got, your work has got different kinds of reactions in English than in Norwegian or in other languages?
Yes, I don't know so much. I don't read so much about what are writing, what people or critics are writing about my books in other countries. So I'm focusing very much on my new work. So I when I'm finished a book, you know, I leave it in a way. I leave it to live its own life, and I start to work on something else. So no, it hasn't had impact on my working and my way of working at all. But what is interesting is that I have this conversation and discussion with my translator, of course, and then I learn so much about other cultures. And that's very, very interesting, because she must, you know, she must, Charlotte Bar. Yeah, she must, you know, try to find the right words to communicate with the English readers.
Yeah.
And then I learned so much about it. So it's very interesting. It's very interesting and challenging, because I know to say to with Ludwig Wittgenstein, to learn a language is to learn a form of living.
Yeah.
So it's language is so existential.
Yeah. Yeah.
to us, and but I hvilken grad, but how important the language is for our lives. It's very interesting. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice question. Really nice answer, I think, too. Other questions?
Thank you. I'm really interested in the way that in many of your novels, there's sort of, I don't know if it's a conscious thing or like they're just in the forefront of your mind, but like in different ways, like in A House in Norway, or these are the ones that are translated into English, but in A House in Norway, a lot of it has to do with like a Polish sort of immigrant. And then in Will and Testament, I think she goes on, or maybe that's in Long Live the Posthorn, she goes on vacation and she sees a lot of refugees in Paris. And in Will and Testament, there's a lot about like relating to kind of Palestinians and like casting her family as Israelis and Palestinians. And I just wonder, like, is that something that you do consciously, or is this just like something in your day-to-day life, or I don't know?
No, it's very consciously. Because we live in a very, very difficult world. And everybody asks themselves, I guess, what can I do? And still we don't do what we think we should do. And then we also feel ashamed because of that. And then, so it's a kind of bad circle sometimes. And we must change that. We must change that. It's so obvious, and to be conscious about the mechanism is—it's just a place to start. So I think that, for example, in a House in Norway, I have had that kind of a conflict with a tenant, and that she has, Alma has. But what she experiences, because she's Nelly this is tenant and the
landlord
yeah. who are quarreling. And it's a very interesting relation, because in, for example, when I'm making a deal, economical deal with my publishing house, and then we are not on the same team.
Yeah.
But when we are selling the book and getting it out, we are a team. But in the tenant and the landlord, it's a purely economic relation, nothing else. But then, I shall not tell about the whole story, but they are fighting when she wants to raise the rent. And the tenant stopped to pay, all that kind of thing. But what she... And they have really fighting. You are living here without paying me.
Yeah.
And she has the feeling that they are stealing money from me. Every day they are living there without paying. They are stealing money. It's mine. It's mine. And they have lived here, a single mom with a child, for 7 years. And they finally have gone. She goes into the apartment, little apartment, and she sees, you know, what you kind of plastic thing you have on the toilet, so that small children can learn to go to the toilet. Because when she moved in, she was pregnant, and she has had it 7-year-old girl, and then she find a doll. And she suddenly understood that this has been a childhood home.
Yeah.
And nobody knows a childhood home like a child because it's tasting.
Yeah.
The relation is so intimate. And then also that she remember and she is then thinking about her own childish home and how afraid she was of strange grown-up people. Mm-hmm. And especially angry.
Yeah.
Grown-up people. And she understands that she has been...
She's been,
Spökelse. A ghost in the little girl's life. And that she will live as a ghost in that little girl's life for the rest of that person's life. So, but she doesn't understand that.
Yeah.
She's caught by the fighting and want to win. So I want to change my characters, and I want to, first of all, I want to change myself.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
That's a house in Norway, which was from 2015, and that's been translated into English. It's the one I haven't read yet, but now I'm desperate to. Let's get another question. There was one at the back first, and then I'll come to you. So I'm really making Claire work, right in the back far corner, and then in front as well.
Thank you. First of all, just make a comment, and then I ask my question. There is a saying in psychoanalysis that one can never get rid of the mother. The best we can do for those who moved overseas is to coalesce.
Oh, yeah.
I ask you a personal question. Have you been in psychoanalysis or through a work of analysis yourself?
Yes. Yes, the answer is yes. Many years. It's very, very interesting. Very interesting. But we have something we say in Norway, at least I say it, that you can inherit pain if it's not treated. And we have a saying that I got a problem from my mother, but I didn't know what to do with it. So I gave it to my children. And that's very...
and that's very generous.
So that's a mechanism that we should be conscious about and to try to treat our own pain so we don't give them away to our children.
Yeah. Thank you. There was another question just in front.
Hi. I just wondered if the issue of estranged daughters is one that you will continue returning to in future work, or do you feel like there is more territory to explore there for you in future novels?
Oh, I'm a little bit tired of bad families. I can. but still, I think that in a long authorship, you are often... kan du si treaten? No, du sier ikke behandle.
Oh,
ikke behandle, altså behandle, men du behandler ikke som sykdom. You hear treat the same job depth, but from many perspectives.
Right.
My new idea is different. So maybe I'll come back in some years and maybe when I've talked with mother.
We'll definitely have you back with that one. Are there any more questions? There's one right over there.
Hi.
Hey.
In Posthorn, you write about a pretty bitter struggle of postal workers in Norway. Mm. It's strange for a novelist to include, you know, working class struggles in their novel. I can only think of Charles Bukowski, mm-hmm. who wrote Post Office. Mm-hmm. What led you to write on that struggle?
Great question.
Yeah, it was.
Sorry, I'm a postal worker in Britain.
Oh,
so
yeah,
that's what
okay,
I
mean. Oh, yeah. That's nice.
Thank you.
I think I was very Kierkegaard inspired because the communication, what heter det, kommunikationsrådgiver, consultant, communication consultant, who is the main character, She has a kind of dead language. If you want to have your cases in the media, I must have conflict. And that kind of, at that time, I was together with a communication consultant.
Okay.
And he was using his one. And I think it's a dead language. You don't feel anything. You don't, it's some, and how can I come? And then I will write about a communication consultant with a dead language. You have to do that. You have to do that to get you into the media, to have it on the program and radio. And then I said, but, and then I want her to wake up, to change, to have a living language. And then she couldn't work for a company that make nail polish or something like that, or perfume. It must, the task for her must to change her language must be to work with something very important, very important. Somehow, the civilization, the development of civilization as the post system is. So then I contacted, but it's also very correct, because at the Workers' Party in Norway, they wanted the third EU directive to go through, but the people on the grand level in the party was denying. And one of the one that was a very young man from Hordaland up in Norway, he held that speech about the post system, and it was so moving.
Yeah.
So a talented, beautiful young man, and he changed the meeting, and they won. So Støre and the prime minister, and they must go with a veto to Brussels, but this guy, he was shot at the Utøya, the 22nd of.
Wow.
A big political talent was killed.
Oh my God.
But I asked his parent if I could refer to his speech, and they very much wanted me to do that.
Was he murdered?
Murdered, yes. Yeah. Murdered.
Not on account of that case, but the terror on 22nd of July in Norway.
Oh, I see. Oh my gosh.
Shot.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
On the camp of the young organization of the Workers' Party in Norway.
Shocking.
So it's a kind of very, in one way, it's very realistic novel about the process, because I was together with the communication consultant that worked with the Fagforeningen, Fagforbundet, the union of the post workers. So it's very realistic. Yeah.
Did you like the novel, sir? That's good to hear, isn't it? It's over there. Long live the postman, if anybody's interested. Gosh, what an amazing story. Do we have time? One more question, if there is one.
I really love your books, and I love how you write about families and trauma, but I feel like we've been talking a lot about mothers, but obviously in Will and Testament, the main abuser is the father, and I'm just curious how you write about the matriarchy versus the patriarchy, and if you think about it in a gendered way, and how that influences your writing.
Yes, it's a very difficult question, and it's a lot to say about it. But when you're mentioning Will and Testament, I have to say one thing, because what I think is worth thinking about that. Then it's a novel, partly about sexual abuse, but then you have the situation. It's so difficult. You have a grown-up daughter saying to the family, my father did so-and-so with me when I was a kid. The father says, looking at the family. No, I did not. Do you think I can do such a thing? And there's no evidence, are there bevis, exempt? No proofs. You must understand how easy it is, how tempting it is to believe in the father. Because if you believe in the grown-up siblings, you know, the sister, can they celebrate Christmas? Can they celebrate father's birthday? Are they going to talk with the rest of the family, the neighborhood? It opens a big black hole of impossibility if you choose to believe in the daughter. But if you believe in the father, everything can continue as before. You can say, you can look upon that, choose as a kind of to save the rest of the family. And it's a kind of B effect that you lose the one sister. So that's why 99.9% of people confronting their family about that kind of anklage, they are not believed.
So I
think it's very interesting. But still, in the Village Testament, many has commented on that Bergljot, the main character, is more angry on her mother. Yes, and that's why, that's because the father has, as Bergljot says, in a way, he has guilt in his, it's written guilt here. He's not a happy man, but the mother is wanting her. Can you come into Christmas as a normal family? She's not taking it seriously, but her father takes it seriously in one way. So I think that's the mother insists to behave as nothing has been said, nothing has happened, and that's what is so difficult to bear for Bergljot. And that's why she's angry on the mother, because mother pretend nothing has happened. Do I have to tell you again what I said? Papa, can't you come so we can be a normal family?
Yeah.
So that's why. Yeah. I don't know if it was a real question, but I think that's a kind of dynamic in
yes.
that kind of conflicts.
Thank you for asking that question. We're going to close with a final reading. And it's a very short one. It's page 313 of the book.
In Rembrandt's painting, Return of the Prodigal Son, the younger son kneels humbly in front of his aged, gray-bearded father as he begs for forgiveness for leaving him. He understands he is no longer worthy to be his son, but asks instead to be his servant. The father places his hands on his son's shoulders. They radiate unconditional love, and his face beams with deep paternal joy. The irreplaceable child he had lost has been given back to him. It's beautiful, but it doesn't belong to the human sphere. Rembrandt's father represents God, and shows us how God welcomes all lost sinners, the greatness of God's mercy. But if our earthly father and earthly mother were anything like God, there would have been no need for us to invent him. So there's nothing that painting can teach you. What would that be? To be humble? To yield? If I could meet her without being frightened or doubting, not proud of my success or vengeful, but completely humble and trusting, with a great devotion, and see mom through the eyes of a child, a gaze that entrusts my entire destiny to her, the noise of the traffic would still, the rustling of the priests would cease. We would be surrounded by total silence and she would be unable to resist having the courage to do that. She hasn't.
Thank you. Thank you, Victor.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.